Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
I keep going to the same orthopedic surgeon, like bones and elbows and wrists and injuries.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks as always for making your way here. Checking out the series and this episode. Hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week, which is a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at all the usual places like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you like to get your podcasts from. I'm Kyle Mayer. Today, once again, talking with Gavin Rosdell, this time about the 20th anniversary of Golden State, a record that found Bush going back to basics, but also with the unfortunate timing of releasing it right before 9/11. The British-born artist tells us about having his songs recontextualized in the aftermath of the Twin Towers, signing with a record label who seemed to fail them at every turn, and eventually losing half of the band in the aftermath of it all. Gavin's also going to take us into his acting career, having just played the villain in Janelle Shirtcliffe's Habit, and tells us why he's attracted to playing bad guys, as well as the time his scenes were cut from Brittany Murphy's Little Black Book movie because screen tests said they had too much chemistry. And we'll also hear what it was like shooting alongside Bella Thorne, Paris Jackson, and The Kills in Habit, and the details on his next movie called The Edge of Nowhere, which is also directed by Shirtcliffe. So let's do it. And the 20th anniversary of Bush's Golden State. It's Kyle Meredith with Gavin Rosdell.
How are you? Nice to see you.
We got a few things to talk about, but the reason I reached out anyway, because it's the 20th anniversary. I got to do the backwards weatherman thing here. 20th anniversary of this little gym right here.
Right.
The Golden State, which is getting the deluxe edition and everything. It's been fun to go back and revisit this one. This was, I listened to it now differently than I listened to it then. I mean, that's going to happen naturally, but it really does sound like, even more so in hindsight, that this was the back to basics record. I mean, it was back to that rock sound. What was the story going into this one?
That was, I think that with Golden State, it was a weird record because that just came out. My memory of that overriding memory is the whole thing of obviously the Twin Towers, because that's when the Twin Towers were hit. I was physically doing press at the Met Hotel in London, and we watched like with horror, you know what I mean? As the plane went into the first tower and then the second tower. So it's surrounded by that, but and what's weird about it is that it was the first label, first time we'd been on a major label, and we signed to Atlantic Records. And so it was this really weird situation of kind of being in people we didn't really know. Then we had the song was called speed kills, which in England is a warning. Speed kills, but people are like, you can't have those two words together. It's like, it's a warning, you know. So it turned into the people that we love. Then the cover, which was this art of the cover art was the plane. Because I was going, you know, that was the beginning, right in the middle of me and Gwen. So I was always on planes for the band and always on plane for my personal life. And so, and then the Golden State is where I was, you know, I wanted to record this this record in America for the first time. And, you know, Dave Sardi, really, really amazing person. He introduced me to Chris Traynor, who then subsequently joined the band after that in 2002. So it's like really full of all these memories and out of this world, you know, we got the privilege of being able to view the site of the 9/11 attacks while it was still smoldering. And my friend took the video footage of it, and we were with a policeman that we know, a marshal that we know really good, so we were allowed. And so I just remember that, and that Golden State tour was just all about playing that elegiac, crazy footage and all the flowers and the people we lost set to that track. And with people that we love, you know, it began, and they're like, oh, I don't want to play anything hard on the radio. I just remember thinking, Out of This World is the most apt, like a lozenge, you know, an elixir against the time. But yeah, I mean, that record is full of massive memories. And yeah, I think it feels like people, Bush fans talk about the record that got away because it didn't have the same impact because everything changed as that came out, you know? And I think everyone at that time wanted to not have rock music on rock stations. It's weird. So it's like full of all those memories, but the memory of making it is really beautiful. And like first time I made a record of America, The Village, and I couldn't believe how well they looked after you when you recorded and treated you like, would you like a coffee? Like in England, you know, people in studios at that point were like, you know, the assistant had the feet up reading the papers and like, you know, you'd be like, excuse me, can I get, like, no service, no help, nothing like that. You come to America, man, California, and the Village recorder, the history. And I just remember they were such great treatment. I just, you know what I mean? It doesn't take a lot to treat people nice, but it really had clearly a big effect. I never thought about it that much since then, but now when I think about it, yeah, they got us coffee every day. And I rented a Jaguar, an old car dealer's car. I don't know why I really liked it. I drove it. It's only after I found out it was like really like $300 a day or something like that. And I'd be just like $2,000 a week sitting in the car park. I'm like, bit of a money burner, but yeah, great. You know, I'm really proud of the record. I always think that, you know, I've had so many records, luckily, and some been really successful, some more successful than others. It's just, does it stand the test of time? That's all it really, do you know what I mean? So I hope it does.
Well, like I said, it is fun. Like you like hit the overture of the entire interview with that answer, by the way. You hit on so many points that obviously 9/11 became a part of it. Wasn't originally part of it. It did become a part of it. I was just getting my start in my career. I think I'd been in only a year or two at that point. I was a music director of an alternative station, and I remember loving Speed Kills as I got it originally, you know, Speed Kills, parentheses, The People That We Love. And of course there were those songs. I wasn't a part of one of the Clear Channel stations who, you know, got that blacklist of songs you couldn't play. But I remember everyone was definitely on edge about what you could and couldn't. I think we continued to play that song. But then it is interesting, just the timing, as you said, because, you know, then you've got a song with the line, I'm a terrorist inside. I mean, just like, what was it like seeing your songs taken from one context and made into something else that it wasn't originally intended? Because it was out of your hands.
Yeah, I mean, you know, before 9/11, the idea of terrorists was not, obviously a horrific word. It's a really powerful word. And so at my best when I'm terrorist inside, was just the sort of thing of being sort of a maverick, you know, like leading away. It's nothing to do with violence. There's nothing to do with hurting people. I'm like freaking, you know, I'm in a rock band that's called Bush. It's like, I don't want any trouble with anyone, you know? So it was nothing to do with like the reality of the word, like a poetic license, you know, pushed to an extreme. But when that came out, it suddenly was like, oh my God, I can't believe I put that word in there. Because we just hadn't really, I don't know, we just sort of, I guess we're so innocent. I mean, I'd grown up in England where you had the IRA fighting the Protestants. So they were like terrorists of kind. I grew up in that whole, where I lived in London, you'd see the Orange Day, the Protestant marching, you know, the pubs or IRA pubs. Biddy Mulligan's was the Irish. It was the, you get stabbed in there if you're like a Protestant. It's like real, the real deal, right? The Cock Tavern. And I was like a kid, you know, 12, 13, I'd be growing up. And when I'd see people, like, for instance, the Orange Day parade where the Protestants come out, it's just wild to know that, because they had their sort of militia segment to them. So as a kid, like, seeing people that are like, you think, wow, they really are terrorists. You know what I mean? That's the real deal. Oh my God, don't look at them, don't stare at them too long. They're like, stab you, you know? And so it's just a powerful line. You know, for me, I try and make my words as powerful as kind of exotic as possible, you know? And it was an unlucky choice. And then coupled with the plane, it was actually, I'm sure you must have seen the image. It was a really good album title, cover art. And I worked really hard on it with the guy up at Atlantic, actually, Martin Ogolchier, whatever his name was. And then that went to poop. And then it was like, okay, make it gold. So it kept on being a reduced version of what it was. I think that if you're going backwards, I mean, like Dave Chappelle is like, fuck you, I stand by what I say. Right? You know what I mean? Okay. But it's like this sort of, you know, everyone wants to backtrack. And I was like, the album title, the album cover, the song name, At My Best on Terrorist Inside, At My Best on It's All Me, you know. And so I think when you're doing that, you kind of tend to lose your balance. And so that's why it has this sort of, and then being with Atlantic, who just were awful and just didn't have any solutions for, didn't say, okay, we can't play that song, but look, Out of This World, you're playing at the shows, it's like an anthem, that's a beautiful thing. Let's do something with that, let's make something beautiful. No, they just like went off. It was like typical what you hear major labels. It's a massive deal we got with them, but it's the worst label in the world. Oh my God. So that was just unfortunate. That was just a really unfortunate thing. And then that means that you then have these, becomes like a relatively secret record, you know. We'd be used to, like, you know, all these number ones, and that was like, that went away a little bit, but such is life. I'm looking at the numbers. I mean, what you do is, like, if you stick around long enough, you're gonna have all kind of things happen to your records. You know, I've had, you know, with this interview's not about other records, but every record has it's a sort of snapshot of time, isn't it? And you know, I mean, I just had this last record, The Kingdom, which was a, you know, really did well and lots of streams, but, you know, obviously Corona shut us all down, so that was done, you know. So it's been unfortunate.
It's been interesting, musicians that have been around long enough that are in the similar boat, that have had an album come out in 2001 and had to deal with 9/11 and then had a pandemic album, and how the two sort of related in story, you know. It's
but you do find it, you know what I found weird when I was growing up, right, was you know, liking, so I really love, like, you know, I love Neil Young, he's amazing. And then as you get older, you realize, oh wow, look, there's four records in between those two songs that I liked, you know, there's all this material. So if you're around long enough, you just, I don't know, you amass a lot of material. And I think in those days, they were quicker, they'd write a record and, you know, two records a year and touring, and who knows how they did it, but that's how they do it. So I don't know.
You're right though, Out of This World is a beautiful song. It is one that I revisit, and Inflatable. Yeah. That is one of the prettiest songs. And I remember getting a single to that one too. And just, I mean, just being floored the first time I heard that. You've always done great on those ballads. And they always stand out. I mean, I you know, all the way back to the beginning, I know, but even today, there is something like, you know, everybody talks about the lightning in a bottle with songs, but there's magic in that one, for me at least, with Inflatable. There's real magic.
We did the Chris Isaak show up in Canada at that point, and I played that song on there, and it was so beautiful. He said to me, man, there's one hell of a song, that's your next hit. It wasn't, because I was on a label that didn't know. You know, that was a great solution to the problem of, like, make something mellow. And we did, there's this one guy that I wanted to work with forever, Giuseppe Capitondi. He made these amazing videos. Finally, he's going to work with us. And we did the video about someone else. It was like the worst creative decision ever. So we just like on stage, like Muppets. And it's like, it's meant based on the Deer Hunter and that last, the wedding before they go away to Vietnam. And really sweet kids were, you know, the boy and girl, but they were the stars of it. It's like, we literally, it was just all kinds of wrong. And I think that it's a testament actually, in fairness, to being surrounded by the right people that are, I didn't have a very good manager. And I had a terrible label. So before and since then, like now I have a wonderful manager and a pretty supportive label. And it's a bit collaborative, you know. And so there we just, just one calamity after another. Not the music though, just a sort of, didn't, you know, if we made an incredible video, maybe that would have helped, but we made the least good video that we made just because it sounds so good. The idea, when we were doing it, I was thinking, but we're just sidemen in our video. We're just like literally playing this wedding. The video is all about these kids going away. I was like, oh God. So, you know, as I say, it's beautiful to look back and thank you for your kind words about it. I'd rather we look back and see quality than it's just sort of, you know, than otherwise.
Well, let's focus on the songs then just for a second, outside of the machine. Do you remember writing that one, Inflatable?
Yeah. Yes, I remember that. I do remember writing it because it was finding this really weird little guitar part that fit all the way through. I like kind of a pedal tone things, you know, so you just have these like cycles of repetition and certain notes that hold and then the melody moves around it. And then I remember Dave Sardi played this solo on it. He played the kind of like twangy, and it was really contentious because like the guitar player, Nigel, was amazing guitar player, but he's kept on playing all these bluesy solos all over it. And I was like, I don't know if that's the right approach really. And then Dave just knocked one out and I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then somehow it stayed. Oh yeah, Nigel left. He went to England. He sort of was, he came to America to record, but we spent the time at his house by the pool. Like he said, he had enough of being there and he came home and somehow that solo stayed on there. So it was unfortunate. It's Dave Sardi's last solo, I think.
That was happening though. I mean, Nigel left, Dave Venture left. I mean, this, and it was the last Bush record like for a while.
It's like a war of attrition with me. I'm always the last one standing. I'm the Barking Smith of Bush.
Did it feel like something was coming to an end around that time? I mean, here you are, you're making a great record. You're in the middle of writing, you're recording, you've done this, you know, many times before, maybe not knowing, or did you get a sense that, I don't know, that there might not be a Bush for a while after this? Like, when did that happen?
That was just like, I think that what happened was that Nigel, not to speak for him, but that was around the time when he started to reflect that he really had missed the first few years of his first kid, you know, and he was about to have another baby and didn't want to forfeit that time. And then I think when we made the record in America, I just think he'd had enough of it. I mean, you know, I've seen him in interviews talking about how the business got in the way. I don't know quite what it means. I think that we left a small label that had done really well for us to go to a big label, and we left a great manager to go to a terrible manager. And we just got seduced by the wrong things. We got seduced. It's like, you know, we got seduced and woke up in the morning with like not a very good manager and not a very good label, but on paper they're meant to be the best. And I'm sure they are for some people, just not for us. It was a terrible mix. And Nigel didn't like the new manager. And I thought the new manager, you know, I always believe in people. I thought this is going to happen. So there was a lot of flux when I think about it. And it's only in talking to you about it that I sort of unearth all these emotions.
I'm glad I could be here to help you with that.
Thank you so much. What a can of worms. So I could just tell that there was not so much a rift between us. It was never, see, things with us were so English. It was never like character, personality, you know, disconnect. Like, I love those guys. We never had any arguments about anything. It just was more like we'd given our lives so much by then. That was 1999, it was 2001, right? 2001. So yeah, it'd been like, you know, it'd been kind of a slog, 6 or 7 years. And I think they just had enough and wanted a lifestyle change. And I'm still crazy ambitious. And I don't know why, I just really like it. I'm like fired up and just, you know, like gung ho. And they didn't share that enthusiasm. And, you know, I don't know. Nigel came from sort of a real kind of punk background where bands only lasted a certain amount of time. I think he saw, it's exactly the same time, here's another one. He saw the Strokes. Mm-hmm. He saw the Strokes, and the Strokes had just come out with Last Night. And I was like, that's so cool. That's inspiring. He was like, that's so cool. We're done. That's the future. I was like, well, to some people, but to some people, they, I don't know. And so for him, that was a big turning point, which was in a way, I really respected it, because it was like, not like someone like me fucking hangs on for dear life and doesn't want to get like kicked out of the dance competition. He's like, you know what? I've been dancing for 7 or 8 years, sold millions of albums, I've traveled the world, I've had this family, and I missed my first kid growing up, and I'm not going to do it with my second. Or if we do tour, we're going to really minimize it. I was like, how can we can't go up against people who want all the slots, want radio, want slots on festivals and stuff like that. If we're sort of like part-timers, we're not doing the, you know, paying the dues. I just sort of old-fashioned. So, God, I didn't realize what a turning point the record was. Golden State should be in total state.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead. Download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach. It's interesting that you said that because, you know, it's being the 30th anniversary of Nevermind. Like, that was the conversation then, you know, all the bands that had come before,
right,
saw the writing on the wall with Nevermind. I mean, you've shown that you can coexist. Obviously, you know, you continue your career after that. So it's not like you went away once the Strokes did, in the same way maybe Twisted Sister went away. I'm not comparing you to Twisted Sister, by the way. Yeah, but
Yeah. I mean, it all comes down to what do you, you know, what you do it for and what your vocation is. And Nigel is a fucking amazing, talented guitar player. Brilliant, brilliant guitar player. And he had just wanted a life switch. I still love it. I'm in my studio now. The minute we finish, I'm going to continue to work on songs from the new record. I just, because I love that. I've just been with my kids. I'm really full on with my kids, and they're at school, and then now they go back to their moms for a week. And I'm like literally excited about this. Like, we will finish this interview, then I'll like turn it on. And I had a great breakthrough in a song yesterday. There's a couple of things I got to put a vocal to, and then tomorrow the engineer comes, because I'm a horrible engineer. But I can sort of get everything going and all my sections together and write and all that. And then I use like my little iPhone dictaphone and get it going. And then when he comes in, then we put it all together. And, you know, it's kind of done like that. But so I think that's what it was. It was just a turning point. And I respect his position, and I know that. And, you know, I am hogging up the airwaves to a certain degree, but I've written some great ballads on this new record, for example. But I would say, if you like those other ones, you'll definitely like the songs I've written for this record. So this is exciting, you know. It's just, I believe that music is a, you know, like your career. So nice when you're just a passion to do it. You know what I mean? You have a passion to do it, whether the 10 strokes or not, you know. I mean, I could look at so many bands I could look at and be like, okay, no need for doing this anymore. You know, like certain great big bands. But I've always had this idea that, people just need great records. Doesn't matter if they have, you know, wouldn't you love to have 4 records you go between that you totally love? You don't need to have, you know, I remember when Nevermind came out, you know, Soundgarden and Louder Than Love, whatever, that's kind of slightly looked over. That wasn't quite, you know, it was a Nirvana thing, but that's an equally brilliant record and equally brilliant band. that sort of just found their place again. You know, you just, quality finds its place.
Yep. I agree. You know, you and I got to talk about last year, The Kingdom was a fantastic record that I'm still listening to. And the accompanying live album that came out with that. I mean, those get a lot of play around here, you know, Thank you. Thankfully you continued with that stuff because you're still making quality records. And as a greedy fan, the only thing I want you to do is to hurry up and make new music, but I still have more questions. So I'm getting in my own way right now. And I only want to bring up that it is the 20th anniversary of this, meaning that there is a 20th anniversary deluxe edition coming out. And it does include a few of those B-sides with American Eyes and Japanese Freight Train and Fireball, which here's one of those things. An artist makes a decision at some points and some songs make it and some songs might not feel right. I listen to Fireball now and I go, oh my God, what an incredible song. You know, and it's one of those moments as a fan, we're like, how did this not make the record? And yeah, I'm sure it was a decision at that point.
Yeah, all those decisions are hard. You know, it's a high class problem. And it's unusual that they're actually real sleeper songs don't come out whatsoever, because they're always kind of mining you for some, you know, Austrian deluxe edition. And you're like, they used to do always for Japan, actually, traditionally. And Universal, Interscope, never had any acts, it seemed. I mean, when I knew that No Doubt didn't do well in Japan, I was like, that's got to be the label's fault. That's the, you know what I mean? If Gwen wasn't right for Japan, she ain't right for anywhere. So when they, so we never, unfortunately, I love Japan. It's the greatest country. I love it so much. I never really did very well there. We always played the Liquid Rooms. We just stayed at a certain kind of level there. And so they'd be the one place that always was insisting on bonus tracks. So I'd be like, no, until there's like a major audience there, I only get the bonus tracks where the people are. Crazy. But somehow that track never got, and I funny because I listened through it the other day, I was like, oh, that's pretty good. I'm always waiting for it to, whenever I hear these extra tracks, I'm waiting for the one reason, because I think songs are as good as their weakest bit. So, I mean, they're not, because often we grew up with songs, choruses we love, and then sometimes if you were to read the words of the verse, you're like, what's that bit? You know, that bit's where you're not paying attention. You know, it's all Beavis and Butthead. You know, it's like, where's the chorus? You know, quite a few songs I hear like that, where I'm like, what's this? And then you hear the chorus. But so I'm always waiting for the weakest bit of the song. And in Fireball, I was like, wow, because that was what would turn me off a song, if I played two songs next to each other. In, you know, even though one may have this great bit, if it's got a weaker section where I kind of lost the plot as a songwriter or whatever like that, I'm just going to ixnay that because or edit it out. And with Fireball, it was weird because I heard it, I was like, what was this? Why didn't this go somewhere? This is weird. So, you know, I remember, you know, as soon as I heard it, I was like, oh God, that track. I've written so many songs. It's crazy.
Well, that's, I mean, you got Fireball, bring up a famous one like Broken TV, Bubbles, you know, that type of stuff. I mean, you all have you ever put out a B-sides record? You haven't, right?
No.
Encouragement. That's what I'm throwing here. Encouragement.
We've never done a greatest hits and we've never done a B-sides. We've waited so long for the greatest hits. No one cares about greatest hits anymore. Which, like, remember back in the day, like, I don't know, 5 years ago, you could get like a, you know, you could be a big deal. You get an advance and the whole big thing, the greatest hits. I it always confused me. I'd be like, why can't people just play the songs they like off the, oh no, they like it in one greatest hits. So we were like saving. We saved it so long, it's worthless now. No one cares about greatest hits. Oh, shit.
But the B-sides record would still work because you press it to vinyl and now it's a fan thing, you know. That's right. That's,
yeah. I there's something as well that I do like. I think that there's something human and touching about sort of doing things wrong. I always considered that we've generally done most things wrong, being in rock band in England during Britpop, come to America. You know, everything's the wrong way around. So the fact that we never did a greatest hits is like, because I always thought that was like, you know. Okay, it's a swan song. And, you know, I was like, no, don't rap, because I can't bear the, I always want to go forward. And I love what got us here. And I love the framework of all the history of all the songs. But as a songwriter, I'm like, you know, I always wanted to go forward. And I don't not play those songs. I still love all the songs, the hits that people know. I'm not mad at them at all. But I, you know what I mean? I just want to push forward. just a natural feeling.
Well, and you continue to do that. I'll quickly bring up, not just in your music, but in other arts as well. Meaning specifically right now, you've also you're also part of a new indie film called called Habits. And once again, I think you've pointed this out in a different interview, pits you as a bad guy. You've got a career as a bad guy. Where does that come from? What is it? Is it the filmmakers look at you and say, bad guy, or is that what you're attracted to?
What a piece of shit. I don't know. It seems to what I get offered. I think that until you play the, never tried. I did one romantic comedy, to be honest. I never wanted to do that. I always thought, I'd much rather be killed, be a bad guy, be devil's emissary, be shot, be tortured, because it gives you longevity, gives you returnability in film. If you're like, you go in a romantic comedy and you're like a house painter falling in love with Reese Witherspoon or something like that, you've probably got like 5 minutes in your career, unless you're Ryan Reynolds or something like that, right? And they asked me, would I read this film? And it was a Little Black Book. And I was like, yeah, it's a romantic comedy. And, our strategy is we're not doing that, right? Because we want to keep lean and mean. If I'm going to be in a movie, keep it mean. So I went out to Canoga Park and said, we'll just take a meeting with Brittany Murphy, because that's a film with Brittany Murphy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, but I'm not doing it. I mean, I'll go out and meet her because I don't want to be rude, but I'm not going to. And it was Julia Roberts' producing partner and the director. And I was getting to this at Winnebago, and Brittany Murphy leaned across me, took me by both hands and said, please, will you do this movie with me? I was like, of course I will. Folded. Yes, of course. And weirdly, we had really good rapport in it, and I was a side character, but I all got cut out of the movie completely. I think maybe there's one scene to be left. They said that the tests came back, there was too much vibe between me and Brittany, and they didn't understand what my character was and why I was in it, so they cut me out. They should have extended my part, grown it, But so I generally have always played bad guys, and this one is no different. They're more interesting, aren't they? I like people that, we're all human, we all mess up, and we all could do better, we all try better. And so they're more interesting people to play. I mean, that guy in Habit is a washed up TV star selling cocaine to young Hollywood. I don't know why that's the only thing he could have done, sell coke, but apparently that's all he could do. So I don't know, it just it was fun playing him, and I like acting. It's fun, and I think it's a great movie. Actually, Janelle Shercliffe. I'm doing my next movie with her. I'm doing a movie with her now coming up, and she's brilliant. I think she's a really, really talented director. So, yeah, I like doing that. I mean, nothing beats the thrill of writing a song and getting the alchemy of a song together. But it is fun making words come to life and. Being real, I mean, Bella Thorne is a really good actress. So it was really fun. Also, Jamie from The Kills is in Habit. And I'm a huge fan of The Kills. So I did a whole lot of work with Jamie. And that was really, I was like, a bit of a huge fan of his band. But we didn't talk about music at all. We went to work. And I was thinking, I didn't even know if he knew I was in a band or anything. He's like cool and all that. And at the end of it, after like 3 or 4 days working together, like big hugs and really, 15 hours a day on the set, I gave him a hug and I was like, I got to tell you, I love your band. Your band's unbelievable. It's one of my favorite bands. So they are literally one of my favorite bands. And he goes, oh man, I love your music too. I was thinking, no, I don't know if he does, but it was a really nice thing to say. And he was really fun to work with.
Yeah. Looking at that cast too, because, I'm a huge fans of The Kills too. In fact, I had Allison on the show not too long ago, but you got Jamie and Allison, you got Paris Jackson, Bella Thorne. I mean, everybody was a musician basically. And hearing you say, but at least with Jamie, you didn't talk about music. And I'm like, that's maybe you just don't talk about work at work. But I was like, oh, that's surprising. Just with all that music talent in one place.
So much. I would love to. And I it's only Corona. I haven't seen him since. Cause we vowed to stay friends. And he's in London now, so he missed the premiere. But there's quite a bit of pressure on those things because especially indie movies, they move so quick. You've really got to know your lines. You've really got to have your act together or else you're just holding up a production that can't afford you. You know what I mean? Production can't afford it. So I find myself, work hard. I just think you go show up on time, know your lines, and stand on your marks, and that's 93% of it. Because generally they've cast you because you look right, you know. So that's what you concentrate on. For Jamie, you know, Jamie was originally an actor. Do you know his band was formed, was signed because someone saw him do a theatre piece up at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Mm-hmm. So he was an actor. So for him being doing a movie was a really big thing for him, I think. You know, and he was really good in it. But when we spend time, we'd rehearse the scenes because you just, you know, it's all fun and games. You don't want to be the fucking one messing it up and ruining it for everyone and back to one everyone. And I've been on big movies where I've forgotten my lines and stuff like that. Oh, it's the word line. It's just the worst feeling of the world. My first movie I ever did was called Game of Their Lives. And I was playing a soccer player. And so my audition was halfway. I had to improvise a speech, which I did. And I got the part. And then I had to go in the car park and kick the ball around over the cars three or four times with Eric Winalda's, because it was a soccer movie. And I spent a lot of soccer. That's it. So when I got to film in Brazil, the night before my big scene was a big speech, you know, like a ballroom full of, meant to be for this in the World Cup. And so it's like, you know, 200 people or 100 people, it felt like 200, but it was 150 people. It was a large ballroom. And I suddenly was like, hang on, I improvised the speech. So there's nothing for me to work on. So I was like writing it and putting it under David Anspore's door, the director. And he's like, yeah, it's great. And I was like, okay. And then so I do the speech like that long. And then he'd be like, okay, take this bit out. Now I can't do that. Like I can only do songs from the first line. If I can't get the first line of a song, I can't tell you any lyrics. Once I get the first line, I can do 2 hours or 3 hours. It's not a problem. But so he did the worst thing for me, which is like, first of all, it was my first movie. Secondly, he would take large chunks out. So now I'm trying to act, but not memorize the words, actually say the words. But now I'm, and so just a couple of times, I just was like, I don't even know what the fuck to fucking say. I got no connection to the words, not even on the tip of my tongue. It's nowhere. And that moment. So I vowed then to just, whenever I did movies, to just shock people by always knowing my lines. I did a movie, How to Rob a Bank, which was a really potentially great movie. It didn't work out so great, but that was after $100 million movie. I did $1 million movie, and we shot it downtown in this bank. And the poor extra, so I'm gonna play a bank robber, true to form, you know, bad guys, so I'm a bank robber. And I'm in there, and these poor extras are lying on them, you know, those lovely old banks and marble floors, uh-huh. You know, like marble floor of a bank, like beautiful ornate right. Floor, ceiling, you know, amazing. Not great to lie on, it's freezing cold and stuff all day when they're in the machines, right? And so I'm friendly with the extras because I don't like it when people aren't, you know, so I felt bad for them because they're like literally lying on the ground and it'd been this alleged hostage position, right? And I said to this girl, I said, how you doing? You're right down there. She goes, yeah, it's great. It's just so wonderful to be on a film where someone knows their lines. I was like, where's she been? She's 12 hours on the marble floor. But the upshot is that I do know my lines.
Yeah, that's all it took. You know, it only takes a little to go a long way in those instances right there. That's cool. Well, I love hearing that you've got more on the way on that too. So yeah. That's great. Is it something you're shooting or you've already shot? I don't know what you can say
about it. We're
just
working on the script now. It's called The Edge of Nowhere. And we're just working on the script and just finessing that and hopefully shoot it early next year. I mean... It's like a love story in reverse, super dark and really like a horror story. It's cool.
Well, I can't wait to see that one.
Keeping the kids cheerful.
What you do, it's what you do, especially I'm going to tie it all around with everything, with, you know, some of my favorite slow songs too on this record here. I keep doing that. Look at that. It's there you go. With the Golden State and with the Kingdom. And I love hearing that you're already at work on some new one and you're promising me some good ballads as well. So that's, I'm going to hold you to that as much as I can.
I already have three. I mean, there's this Float, Reasons, Land of Living. And my engine's with you. Like we did a fast song. You know what I should do one day is just do a regular, not fast version of that. I was always like at the time, I was like, we need a fast song. You know, I want that moment in the crowd where people go nuts. And it was too fast for everyone. It was too fast. No one knows what. But that song was a poem I wrote for Gwen, actually, and I turned it into a song. And I kind of, you know, did a romantic gesture, then like took the romantic gesture back and put it into a song.
Because you can, because it's your song.
Because I can, and I did, and I will.
Gavin, it's been fun as always talking to you. Thank you so much. Congratulations, 20 years on this one right here, and with the Kingdom. I do still love that record, and I guess we'll see you next time you got something else.
Thanks, man. Bye.
My thanks to Gavin Rosdell. Again, the 20th anniversary of Bush's Golden State is now out. Dig a little deeper into this podcast series, the Kyle Meredith With series. If you search for Gavin Rosdell Bush, you'll find my interview from not only last year when we talked about the Kingdom, but all of our interviews from the past is all in that episode. So if you want to dive deeper into my history with Gavin, again, search for Kyle Meredith with Gavin Rosdell and Bush in this podcast series. And while I'm at it, I also want to thank you for listening to this episode. Again, there's 3 new interviews put out every week, a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all of them. After that, head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all 3 of them, at Kyle Meredith, at TikTok, at Kyle M. Meredith. Do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Godspeed. I'm an atheist.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media. It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Hey there, it's Kyle Meredith from Kyle Meredith With. After you check out the latest episode of my show, be sure to check out some of our other great programs on the Consequence Podcast Network, including Standing BTS, a bi-weekly podcast covering all things BTS and ARMY, and The Opus, Consequence's original documentary podcast exploring legendary albums and their lasting legacies. So head to consequence.net to listen to these podcasts and many great others.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.